sharing ideas about money, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Share Radio Morning with Georgie Frost.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money Show. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And this week, we focus on business, from the big supermarkets to the micro-entrepreneurs. And for once, it's not all about Brexit. It's been bad news for Sainsbury, knitters and curry houses. Good news for hairdressers and Peru. But let's land closer to home and head to the supermarkets first, where the falling value of the pound, stiff competition, rising inflation and savvier shoppers look to be spelling more trouble for the sector. We've got some rather bad numbers out this week from Sainsbury. Profits were down 8% and they reckon costs will continue to rise, a sign of a wider problem. Richard Perks is retail analyst at Mintel.
You've got the fundamental problem here that supermarkets, superstores are losing market share. For Sainsbury's, there's a small offset there in the fact that convenience is doing better and their non-foods are doing better, clothing in particular. You've got a bonus from Argos, but of course you've got the shares issued to buy Argos. And then there are all sorts of exceptional items which go into the number. The underlying story is that profits are under pressure at the superstores, and that's going to continue to be the case. I think the fundamental problem for all of the superstores, all the major retailers, is that there is a shift of population back into inner cities, and those people are shopping much more on an as-needs basis. They're not going to the superstore anymore. And that, I think, is going to be a fact of life for all of them, really for the foreseeable future.
Sainsbury's bought the home retail group, which includes the Argos and Habitat brands, for £1.4 billion last year. These figures were the first to show whether that was a good idea, and it seems, well, it might be. Merging the operations has produced a cost savings of £130 million and a profit contribution from Argos of £77 million.
The average spend uplifts between £6 and £8 for anybody that pops in to pick up perhaps something they've ordered online with Argos. And as they're in Sainsbury's, oh my goodness, why don't we buy this and that? That's what they're betting on. And it actually seems to work. The trouble is, Ed, they've got to go through this transitional phase of shutting down some of the old Argos stores, inevitable integration costs. So I was looking at the numbers myself, and the trouble is you spend in order to save in the future, and that saving comes actually next decade a bit more.
Chris Bailey from Financial Orbit speaking there. So a very warm welcome, Simon. A very warm welcome, Lee. Simon, I'm going to come to you first. I thought Sainsbury's, when we discussed this in the past for our taste test, were doing rather better than the other big supermarkets. What's gone wrong?
Well, that's true. Sainsbury's had been doing rather better than the other big supermarkets. And actually, when we saw this big crisis of confidence at some of the major supermarkets, Sainsbury's actually continued to trundle on fairly nicely. It was obviously exposed to outside factors, you know, the supermarket price war, low inflation that we were worried about at that point, but it was doing all right. And one of the key things, I think, surrounding that was that Sainsbury's had managed to maintain something of a focus on its customers and the quality of its food. And it had carved out a bit of a niche for itself, which if you'd have transported someone forwards from 20 years ago, maybe they would have found a bit surprising, where Tesco was starting to look a bit down market. The food wasn't great. It wasn't very inspirational. They'd sort of not bothered about their customers very well, and customers were grumpy. Whereas Sainsbury's was seen as having fairly inspirational food, pretty good quality, decent prices, nicely laid out stores. However, what has happened recently is obviously what normally happens when any business does quite badly is it either continues to do badly and eventually goes bust, or it has something of a bounce back. And we have seen the headlines grabbed by Tesco and Morrisons because they've been having a bounce back, so they've been doing well. And Sainsbury's could have just really been trundling along pretty nicely, apart from one small problem. The tail end of all of those issues and the supermarket price war is that prices have been very keen in our supermarkets, yet inflation is on the way up due to the Brexit vote-induced fall in the pound, and supermarkets are now struggling in a bit of a squeeze because they are trying to keep prices down for customers and also to keep customers coming in the door. At the same time, they're seeing their costs rise as producers are saying, you need to either pay us more money for this stuff or we're just going to keep sticking it in smaller and smaller packages. So that's where the squeeze is coming from.
So in that regard then, are Sainsbury's figures perhaps more reflective of the wider industry and their warnings about cost risings due to inflation, as opposed to Morrison's? And I remember, Lee, you back in the day saying, look, if you were to put your money on one of them falling down, it would be Morrison's. Yet we heard from them this week, another increase in sales in the 13 weeks to the 30th of April grew like-for-like sales by 3.4% ahead of expectations. So who do we believe?
This is it, right? So Sainsbury's has been sort of trundling along for a little while. It was doing things pretty well. And it's not like it's all of a sudden not doing very well in the fact that it hasn't changed much. Tesco's, Morrison's, you know, they were starting to struggle for a couple of years. They were seeing sales fall. They've done a few things to start changing things around, and that's cut into Sainsbury's a bit. And then we've got the German discounters, Aldi, Lidl. You know, more people are giving those guys a chance and giving them a go, and that's cutting into Sainsbury's market share. Even places like Iceland, you know, they're doing pretty well at the moment, and people just don't have supermarket loyalty anymore. And I think that is a key thing for Sainsbury's, and it's going to have to look at itself in the next 12 months and see what it can do to change around its fortunes.
We saw M&S announce as well this week, didn't they? They're going to go into the online space. Good idea. You're not convinced, are you?
Do you know what, Georgia? I'm not convinced by all of this online shopping and online deliveries and things like that, because I don't know. I kind of get it, but I feel like a lot of it is a bit loss leading for some of these supermarkets. So Sainsbury's, for example, you can get your shopping delivered for a pound. The amount of vouchers I get, spend 50 quid, get £10 off if you get an online shop, that's a serious amount of money, isn't it? So if you get a shop for exactly £50 and get £10 off, 40 quid and a free delivery, I mean, that
it's
is...
It's the loyalty, though, isn't it? They reckon that if you book all your shopping online with them, it's just so easy that next time, click and go again. No?
I don't know if it really works like that. It doesn't work like that for me. I will just get one of those vouchers and use it once, and then I'll wait for another one of those vouchers because I think, well, I've had that once, I'll have it again. You know, I don't have a big family, and it's just two of us in our household, so perhaps that is a factor in it, and perhaps people do that, and people are loyal and it works for them to get their online shop. But I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, M&S seems to be on a real attack at the moment in the food market. The amount of M&S food stores I'm seeing pop up around my way in Essex, absolutely incredible. Whether it be a standalone small supermarket in a high street, or there seems to be a big drive at the moment to have them attached to petrol stations. I'm seeing those M&S food stores pop up all the time.
On flights as well?
On flights, you know, they're on a massive attack at the moment on their food stuff, but the clothes side of the business isn't doing that well. So M&S is looking at the food market, and it's kind of doing pretty well in that sector at the moment. It's kind of probably trying to tackle a bit of the Waitrose crowd, you know, the sort of that type of shopper that probably sees M&S Food and Waitrose in the same sort of vein. But, you know, perhaps online shopping, you know, it will be a big boon for it. But I just, I'm not convinced by the whole thing. Until I see how these business models are profitable, I believe it.
But diversification seemed to work for M&S. Their clothing was struggling. They've gone with their food. That's doing well. You got Sainsbury's. They had Argos. That seems to be doing well as well. Is that the way it's heading?
Yeah, but is M&S food done really well because it's exactly the kind of thing that you want as a kind of convenience thing? So lunchtime, it does great. After work, people on their way home from work, just going to nip into M&S, just going to pick something up for dinner. What greater example of that could you need than that deal they did, the meal and a bottle of wine for a tenner or whatever it was? But just going back to that losing money on the online stuff. Now, online supermarket shopping is great. I am a convert. I was not a convert for many years. I actually like to walk around the supermarket and get some inspiration as to what I'm going to cook that evening. However, my wife started doing this. We get the delivery once a week. Absolutely brilliant. Don't need to worry about doing the big shop. But we had a story going back to October last year. We discussed this on the show, actually. I seem to remember back then. Big four supermarkets lose £5 to £7 on every online order. Neil Craven, one of my colleagues on the Mail on Sunday, spoken to Dan Murphy, a partner at global retail consultants Kurt Salmon, and he'd warned that the big four supermarkets are losing £5 to £7 on every online order that they do.
Wow.
And he said he delivered this brilliant line. He said, "You're selling tenners for a fiver, but you're convinced that if only you can sell enough, at some point it will become profitable." And that is the issue that faces any shop doing online stuff, is that how do you get over that whole cost element, and what they're charging people for delivery does make it, as Lee said, a bit of a loss leader. They're not charging people enough for delivery, picking, packing and all that stuff to actually make the numbers work for them in the same way they do if you go into the supermarket and buy some stuff.
So what will get them over this hump, or will nothing? Has this sector completely changed? We're seeing a real shift at the moment, and that's even without factoring in, as we said, inflation, Brexit fears. What do you reckon, Lee?
I think a lot of it's down to what you've got locally. You know, if you've got a big supermarket nearby, you're probably likely to use that. Does it need a bit of a shake-up? I think potentially it does need a bit of a shake-up. We're seeing a massive change away from having giant supermarkets. A lot of these giant supermarkets that were planned to be opened by some of the big boys have been shelved because they're realising that people don't want to go and get swallowed up whole in a supermarket for 2 to 3 hours. I think, but then a lot of people don't want to shop online, so it's almost like finding that balance. And I think some of the supermarket chains are finding that balance, and that's why some of the big boys have struggled in recent years. But going back to Sainsbury's taking over Argos, that's actually been a relative success story for them so far. They've started to put lots of digital stores into Sainsbury's, so smaller Argos stores that are just attached to part of Sainsbury's stores. I wouldn't be surprised to see other big supermarkets start snapping up something to put in the store, because these stores have got so massive, it's like you've got enough space to bung an Argos in there. And that seems to be doing pretty well. They're talking about opening 250 in the coming years. They've currently got 59. That's making profit, and Argos seems to be doing relatively well.
All right, so that's not too bad, but trouble may be ahead, as being warned by Sainsbury's, for the supermarkets. We did, though, get some good news this week for independent shops. Could talk of the downfall of the high street be over with more opening than they are closing? Well, it depends on how much you like getting your hair done and your nails done, because in come the barbers and the hairdressers, out go women's clothing shops, curry houses and newsagents. Lee, tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah, so this was some research by the local data company and the British Independent Retailers Association. I found this quite a significant number, but there's almost 105,000 independent shops in the UK's top 500 towns in 2016. And in the last 2 years, there's actually been a net increase, only small, but a small net increase in both years of actually more independent shops opening than closing down. So last year there was a net of 159, which doesn't sound like loads, but I mean, it's still encouraging that there are 159 independent shops that have gone onto high streets or places that have been boarded up and closed down. Because there's nothing worse than going to some towns and seeing that they're run down and these shops are empty and these units are empty. And the high street is dying, you know, somewhat. So it's quite encouraging. Now, what we're seeing is things that are closing, shops selling women's clothing is on the downfall. That might be the rise of online clothes shopping. Boohoo has done very well with some results out of that.
I'm wondering how many of these are independent. And we spoke about, you know, curry houses, newsagents, women's clothing shops. Are independents replacing independents, or are they replacing supermarkets that are struggling, or big stores?
It appears to be largely that independents are replacing independents, and that's why there's just like a small sort of flow of, you know, opening. But you're right. I mean, you can't. There's a Pret that's opened around here recently, isn't there? I mean, there's a Pret.
They're like
much
19th.
Yeah,
I think,
exactly. There's probably
50 metres.
Exactly. And like Costa, you know, all of these places are taken over. But there's still a lot of. I've been going to a fair few UK towns in the last couple of months on my travels. Mm. And it is actually surprising to see how independent, especially outside of London, that a lot of towns still have. And they still have that independent spirit. But there's been a boom. So while Indian restaurants and women's clothing and newsagents are sort of disappearing, and nightclubs, which doesn't surprise me, actually. No. I think that's been a trend that's been going on for a while, because people prefer a swanky wine bar, I think, these days. But there's been a flourishing...
boy.
There's been a flourishing barbershops. Honestly, in the last 6 months, there's been 3 barbershops open in my town. I don't know why there's such a big need for barbershops, but there we go. And hair and beauty salons. But, you know, I'm in Essex, so that's not surprising. And e-cigarette shops. I see e-cigarette shops so often. Yeah, I see them everywhere. That's where newsagents are dying. People can't afford cigarettes anymore, so they go in their vape shop. But this is the changing face of the high street at the moment. So what the research also found is actually the biggest decline in independence is London. But it's encouraging that people are getting out there and starting up their own businesses. And as I say, trying to revive the flagging high streets, I think it's quite important.
I mean, what you did point out there, that there are big regional differences. But anecdotally for me, and I probably haven't been on quite so many trips around the country as you have of late, although I did in the past. To me, just anecdotally, all I'm seeing are charity shops, hairdressers, restaurants and coffee shops. The high street doesn't excite me. In this digital world as well, Simon, is there still a place for the high street? And what will it look like in the future? Hopefully a little bit more diverse than what I've just mentioned.
Yes, I will stand here and defend the high street.
Do.
In the face of the onslaught of your disappointment. I think that what we're seeing is the high street, the British high street, changing? And I think it's changing quite a bit and has changed quite a bit. A bit of a hollowing out. So we've seen lots of shops shutting. Mm-hmm. And we've seen some big chains as well take themselves off the high street. Next has pretty much removed itself from most high streets. It's now either in big malls or out-of-town shopping centres. And it's done very well off the back of that. Now, what you're seeing, I think, in high streets, and I think that this is true of a high street anywhere around the country, is you're starting to see two things emerging. One is the chain coffee shop, low grade, not a pound shop, but pound shop style place that sells everything under the sun. And at the other end, you've got the more interesting independents. And okay, they might be a reflection of lots of things that you see everywhere. They might be another barber's, it might be another nail shop, it might be another coffee shop. It might even be an estate agent. but they look more independent. They look more boutique-y. They look more modern. And I think what they're doing is they're trading on this element of people are more willing to spend on experience, more money on experience now. So we're spending less in the shop on the less in the women's clothing shop and more on going out to dinner and things like that. And I think that those places that you're seeing actually now, even if you go up north to some of the places where there's not so much money, you do see these nice little independents. They look much better, they feel much better, and it's kind of like a modernisation. But I think it's nice to see that modernisation coming from independent shops as well. So, yes, I probably wouldn't be holding my hands up and cheering the arrival of yet another charity shop on my street in the same way that I wouldn't be holding up my hands and cheering the arrival of a Costa. Mm-hmm. However, if someone opened up a nice independent coffee shop, I think, well, yeah, there you go, that's great. So I think that maybe we need to differentiate a little bit between the two things, the sort of chain homogenisation of the high street and these little independents that might be doing a similar thing to those other shops, but hopefully doing it better and getting business in off the back of it. Those good independent restaurants will always shine through. It must be so hard opening a new independent restaurant. That worry of you open the doors, like, will anybody come in the doors? And I'm lucky enough to live near something of an old-fashioned high street that is full of independent shops, and it's also full of independent restaurants, Stroud Green Road. New ones open all the time, and you see them and you think, oh, I really must support them, I really must go in the door. And then sometimes it's terrible, they close before you've even managed to get in the door. And you know, once upon a time I would have been straight in the door, but it's harder, I've got kids now, I can't take them out to dinner every night of the week. But I think hopefully those good ones will shine through. But I'll tell you what I think is we've seen, you know, people talk about technology deflation, where basically the technology that you can buy for the same amount of money might cost you the same, but it's so, so much better. So you're actually getting something so much better. So you've got this kind of deflationary effect going on. I think that in Britain, we've seen a similar thing with food and eating out. The quality of food that you get served up when you eat out now, if you choose wisely, is so much better that even allowing for the places charging you ridiculous amounts of money, then adding on £3 for some chips with your steak. I think you're actually getting so much more bang for your buck than you were 20 years ago. I think you get far more bang for your buck if you eat out now than you did 20 years ago in terms of quality.
I totally agree with that. And the thing I was going to add actually about the high street and about restaurants in the high street, I'm talking probably a little bit more about outside of London. But I think actually what a lot of councils are starting to do in some towns that have got a bit run down is actually allow flats to be built on the high street above shops, which perhaps before were office blocks and they weren't being used. And what that does is that it's something I think they call like the nighttime economy. So people actually start to go in the high street because they live on the high street, or they live right by the high street. And there's loads of examples of that around my way at the moment. So Southend, for example, there's been a massive boom in affordable flats going above shops, restaurants on that high street. And I think actually that could be the way forward to sort of revive the high street with some better restaurants, with some better bars. And I think that's probably going to be the key.
All right then. We're getting ever smaller though, lads, from supermarkets to independent shops. Now we focus on the micro entrepreneurs. And the government giveth and they taketh away. Last week we spoke about the ditching, for now, of unpopular plans to hike probate fees. Well, something else was ditched this week, which may not be so popular, especially among the knitters, the crafters, the Marie Kondo fans and those who like to open their doors to complete strangers. Yes, millions who use sites like eBay, Airbnb and Etsy. Well, they won't be able to benefit from lower tax bills after the government rather quietly scrapped planned breaks. But that wasn't the only measure that was dropped last week. The tax-free dividend allowance and money purchase annual allowance, a proposed ban on pension cold callings and a digital tax hit set to target small firms and the self-employed are all out of the finance bill. But first, let's focus on the micro-entrepreneurs or the... Are they micropreneurs? Have I just made that up? What were the rules?
The idea was, in this new digital economy, everyone was using the internet to make a bit of money on the side, and that what they should do is they should be encouraged to be micro-entrepreneurs as part of your portfolio career. I mean, for example, one day you could be riding a delivery bicycle, the next day you could be driving an Uber, the next day you could be renting out an Airbnb, and then you could maybe selling some stuff on Etsy and renting out your driveway at the same time. It's difficult for people to find all the time that they can, and through none of this will you have any employment rights, but we won't worry about that kind of stuff. No, joking aside, the idea was that there were lots of normal people, basically, who were making a bit of money on the side, doing an Airbnb, maybe selling some stuff on eBay or on Etsy.
Because of the sharing economy sort of thing.
Yeah, the sharing
thing,
economy, yeah. I love the fact that the sharing economy does not consist of just giving these things away for free. The mercantile economy, perhaps. But these people should be paying tax on this. Now, lots of people don't pay any tax on it at all, but they could get caught out. And I think as part of probably cracking down on a lot of this stuff, and we've seen quite a few crackdowns on this stuff, they decided that maybe they'd bring in a nice simple tax break for it. So you could earn £1,000 a year through doing something like renting out your drive or your room or selling goods online. And bear in mind that renting a room thing is different to the rent-a-room allowance that you also have. And it meant that effectively you could do a little micro business on the side and you could save some tax. A 20% taxpayer, this would save you £200 a year. Not a huge amount, but...
But it's the timing, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, around with HMRC.
Exactly. You don't have to fill in a form and all that kind of stuff. If you're a high rate taxpayer, it's saving £40 a year. I mean, it's, you know, it's nice. It's a nice little tax break. And I think this was an Osborneism.
Yeah.
Announced to great fanfare in the budget. And then also fell victim to the finance bill. This thing that killed off lots of ideas with the excuse that they couldn't get it through before the election. And how much of that is true or how much of it involves ditching ideas that they didn't want to do in the first place, we shall never know. I wonder whether this one will come back. I wonder.
It seems a bit penny-pinching to my mind. £1,000, you don't get me wrong, that's a lot of money. But like I said, faffing around with HMRC, and actually the Chancellor then at the time said this was because the existing tax laws were daunting and complex for those wanting to make money online. So is it any easier now? Is that the point?
That's the thing, isn't it? It's like it probably actually does the HMRC a bit of a favour as well, because they're not having to go through all of these like, little tiny tax returns of people that are just making a little bit of money on the side. And actually, this was one of the George Osborne ideas in a budget that I thought was a pretty decent idea all round. It's not like it was going to cost them absolutely tons of money to do. And lots of people these days do sell on websites or do rent on Airbnb. But what I really liked about this was the stat that last year, 870,000 people who were making money online failed to submit a tax return. Right, so that's a lot of people. That's almost 1 million people.
870,000.
That's according to figures, yeah. And the tax ban is allowed to force websites such as Airbnb and Etsy to hand over details of how much sellers are making. So I think that's a really interesting line. But you tell me, in an austerity government, where on earth there's going to be a team sitting around looking at almost 1 million people who are selling things on little websites and looking at all of their tax affairs. Okay, maybe like some big time sellers on eBay, etc., might get caught out, but they do not have the time to have a look at 870,000 people.
Well, that's the thing.
Accounts.
HMRC are just so busy looking at the big corporates, and you know, I don't know how they have time.
Georgie, careful. Careful now. But I would not be surprised. I think what's happened is, obviously, the snap election's been called, and a lot of, there's just been a lot of flapping around and U-turns and God knows what. And I think now it's almost like the budgets the last couple of years have almost been made redundant. We might as well just wait for one big super budget later on in the year. And I wouldn't be surprised if this makes a comeback, and if it might even have a slightly bigger allowance. Yeah, I won't hold my breath, but you never know.
Simon?
I was just going to say, I think that we should tip our hat here to Rebecca Rutt, our reporter.
Yes, indeed.
Who I believe may have been the first person with this story. There was lots of stuff dropped in this finance bill last week, and this one got missed by everyone, but I think that Becky actually did spot it. And I think that she was the first with this story on Tuesday. There was another quite famous journalist, though, who could have been first with this story on Tuesday, for their first day in a new job. Could have been their front page. The man who launched it himself, the Chancellor George Osborne. He had the opportunity. So there you go.
What about the other measures? Tax-free dividend allowance, money purchase annual allowance, the pension cold calling, digital tax hit. Who's going to go with some of these?
Do you want a quick run through?
Go for it.
Okay, so start me off. What's the first one?
Tax-free dividend allowance.
Right, that is controversial. George Osborne raised dividend tax rates and gave everyone a £5,000 tax-free dividend allowance as a SOP. It was a way of cracking down on people paying them dividends instead of wages, but it was going to hit small investors. So he said to small investors, here you go, here's a new tax break for you, but I am whacking up the taxes. Philip Hammond came in, said, oh, look at all these people dodging taxes. I'm going to bring this allowance down to £2,000, but hey-ho, I'm keeping the old higher rates. So that tax break lasted for slightly less than a year. Well done, the government.
He could have had a real field down his first day. I've got this, everyone. Don't worry. Yeah. There's so many
anyway,
measures.
Quietly dropped from the finance bill. Will it return? Don't know. Controversial, possibly. Next one.
All right. Money purchase annual allowance.
If you take money out of your pension using the new pension's freedoms, so you take it out of a defined contribution pension, then in order to stop you doing something called pension recycling, which involves you taking money out and then paying it back into your pension to get it boosted by tax relief, and then taking it back out and then paying it back into your pension to be boosted by tax relief. And no, readers, your podcast has not got stuck there. I am repeating the same words again and again and again. A lower allowance was brought in for the money that you could pay into a pension each year. That was £10,000, which is pretty low because it includes what you pay in and the tax relief as well and what your employer pays in. And that was due to be cut even further to £4,000, which causes an issue for people who have basically taken a bit of money out of their pension as they were told they could do, continued working, and their employer might make a contribution to their pension because they might actually find themselves in the position of telling their employer, sorry, you can't actually pay any money into my pension because I'm going to get taxed very heavily. That one, again, quietly dropped.
All right, a proposed ban on pension cold calling.
Why this even needed to go through the finance bill or be put through the budget or hasn't been done a long time ago is a mystery to many people. Why it was dropped is even more of a mystery. Mm. The idea is basically you make it illegal to cold call people and try and sell them a pension investment. Obviously, they will not catch everyone who does it, but it does mean that anybody cold calls you, tries to sell you a pension investment, they're immediately breaking the law, therefore makes it much easier to crack down on people trying to flog you things like airport parking spaces or holiday complexes in Belize.
What, that wasn't a good investment? Oh, sorry, why didn't I ask you beforehand?
What an error. Why was this? Because they don't have time to bring it in before the election? Because it's taken them 100 years to try and sort it out so far.
Don't have time.
Right, yeah. Fair enough. Digital tax hit is your final one, Simon.
Plans to force millions of landlords, self-employed people and small businesses to file up to 5 tax returns online every year have been put on hold ahead of the general election. Basically, it's part of the Making Tax Digital project, very unpopular with small businesses who said it was going to cause them a massive headache, lots of paperwork they didn't need to do. That's been ditched too. Will it come back? Who knows? Will any of these things come back? Who knows? Let's see what happens in the election. Maybe Jeremy Corbyn won't like them when he's Prime Minister anyway.
Ooh. We'll see. Okay, then one thing finally on business that is essential to business success, good internet. Now, if you live in Middlesbrough, heck, if you live in Estonia or Peru, you will have better mobile 4G connection than some parts of the UK, according to Which. Bad luck, by the way, if you live in Bournemouth. Beautiful beaches, sadly rubbish for 4G connection. Overall availability in the UK, 65%, meaning users can only access it nearly two-thirds of the time. Pete Morey is from the consumer group Which.
This has a huge impact on your ability to send emails, to browse the web, to use social media, or even to stream TV services on the go. And our mobile phone is obviously central to how we live our lives today. And that's why it's frustrating for people when they can't access emails or browse the internet on the go. And this underlines the need for Ofcom and for the mobile phone operators to make sure that every part of the country gets a decent service from their mobile phone. You know, if you live in Middlesbrough, then you are getting a good availability of 4G, but actually the speed that you're getting, they come 15th in our list. And I think it would surprise people that, you know, we often think about people getting poor speeds if they live in the countryside or in rural areas. But actually what this research shows is that in some of our biggest cities, they're suffering from subpar mobile networks. And this is clearly something that the mobile phone operators need to do more to address. We're calling on the next government to work with Ofcom, to work with the providers, to make sure that there are critical reforms made to our mobile market so that we are delivering better performance and services for customers. And when you're spending so much for your mobile phone, you expect to be able to get a good level of service, not just at home or perhaps in your workplace, but when you're out on the go as well.
Well, the independent coverage analyst Open Signal ranked Britain 54th globally for mobile 4G coverage. Lee, why are we so bad? Honestly, nearly two-thirds of the time, I'd be lucky to get that.
And what would Paddington Bear do? I mean, he'd be able to sort of FaceTime, but Prude, they'd have good connection, but here, he'd be struggling, wouldn't he?
I like the link, Lee.
I thought this was quite interesting in the way that all the good 4G reception seems to be sort of up north. What if they got some, like, supersonic... The further south you go, the worse it gets. So poor old Bournemouth and Poole and Southampton and Portsmouth, they've got bad signal down there. Maybe they're just too busy actually just enjoying the scenery and having a walk around rather than just, you know, mindlessly going through Facebook posts. To be honest with you, it's one of these things that we probably, I think what a large part of this is that we probably invested quite heavily in the 3G network when that was the most available technology. And like any technology, it starts to improve pretty quickly. And then you've got to start rolling out the technology to make the technology work. So that's a large part of that. I think we're very fortunate, though, in this country in the fact that really, on the whole, you can connect to Wi-Fi most of the time anyway. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of people that do want to do things online, shop online, run businesses online, need to be checking emails on the go. And what this research is showing is actually we are lagging behind a lot of the world when it comes to having fast connection with our mobiles. And, you know, you need to have fast download speeds with 4G for things like the internet, emails, streaming videos. And it's just not happening at the moment. But, you know what happened? You start investing in getting more, better 4G network, and then the next best thing's going to, you know, 5G is going
to
come out.
Well, that's it. We're talking about promises to invest in 5G.
Well, this is exactly it. So it's kind of like, it's a lot of infrastructure costs, isn't it, to keep these things running. And you know, we can moan about it and whatnot, but we are very fortunate that we can literally get 4G or 3G on our phones relatively quickly. And let's face it, the large amount of the time we're using it for things like map reading or stuff that's sometimes it's not that essential. But when it comes to small businesses, I would have thought that any small business, you know, worth its salt will have a Wi-Fi connection even when they're outside of their office, you know, dongle or something along that line. So make sure you've always got a good connection, because if you're going on a train journey, for example, you're going on a long train journey, 4G goes in and out like anything. Yeah, and usually they've got Wi-Fi on board and you have to pay for it and whatnot. But it's an interesting bit of research, and to be down lagging 54th in the world?
54th globally, yeah.
I mean, that's pretty shameful.
What I want to know is, just looking at my phone now, and it says 4G. Doesn't say 4G, by the way. Mm. What does E, H and G? G, I assume, is like 3G, 2G, G rubbish. And then H and then E.
I know exactly what it is, Georgie. Yeah? It's called Google It.
All right, fair enough.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Welcome to This Is Money's show. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce, to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website this week. Now, from businesses to consumers, particularly bank customers. Now, £300 million last year was paid out in unarranged overdraft fees. The advice? Well, it's to call your bank and complain if you have been hit. As according to YouSwitch, nearly half of customers did just that, and of those, two-thirds were immediately refunded. Tom Lyon is a money expert at the Price Comparison Service.
One in eight consumers have dipped into their unarranged overdraft, costing them an average of £33 in fees. Two-thirds of customers don't want an unarranged overdraft, but they're being told by their banks that there's no choice and that it has to be there. If you have been charged a fee, try calling your bank. Customers are telling us that if it's the first time that they've had an unarranged overdraft, often the bank will refund the fees. So start by calling your bank. If you're looking for a new bank, if you're switching your current account, make sure you know the fees for your unarranged overdraft before you switch. And if you are constantly in an overdraft and you're finding you're struggling to get out of that, speak to your bank in the first instance. Ask for help. Often they'll be able to help you with a repayment plan. If you're not happy with your bank's response, then you can go to the financial ombudsman.
So first and foremost, I'm going to have to ask you, what on earth is an unarranged overdraft?
So simply, it's just any money that you kind of go over your arranged overdraft. So if you open a current account, you might, say, have a £250 arranged overdraft. Now, if you go into that overdraft, so say you go £100 overdrawn, you're not going to get charged. But if you creep over that, you're at the mercy of the banks. Some charge a daily fee, so you might get charged £5 a day for going over that overdraft limit. So the golden rule is obviously try not to ever go through and use an unarranged overdraft.
Some of these are huge, though. Can't they just put a stop to it? You might be stopped at the supermarket from your shopping going through, but at least you won't go over.
You can put a cap on it. You can say, you know, I don't want to go over this overdraft. And, you know, in some instances, they don't actually let you. If you're not very creditworthy, they probably won't let you go over an arranged overdraft if you can get an overdraft even in the first place. But that is it's a very simple way of looking at it. And you probably can. But let's face it, people are getting further stretched. Credit, there's figures out Bank of England yesterday about credit card borrowing still ticking higher. So is personal loan borrowing. People are struggling. And people are dipping over for everyday essentials, for utility bills, and a lot of people get into that overdraft habit. Payday comes, and they just can't quite dig themselves out of that sort of overdraft hole.
But that's it. These overdrafts are paying for other people.
Exactly.
And to have their free banking.
It's very true. You know, £300 million last year paid out in unarranged overdraft fees. I mean, the banks are, you know, must be putting their feet up and just going, come on, this is some easy money to be made here. As I say, it's very easy to say, well, to stop going and doing that. But a lot of people can't.
Well, you can't if you keep getting fined as well. It makes it even more difficult.
It makes it
even
more
out.
Difficult. You know, if you're getting charged £5 a day for going over your, you know, going into an unarranged overdraft, you know, that can whack. You're looking at, what, 35 quid a week. So it's a lot of money for people. And then, it's a vicious cycle.
Well, Simon, you've been looking at vicious circles. You've been looking at debt. You've been asking the question, will the house of 0% credit cards come crashing down? Floor's yours.
Well, before I say that, I should just say on this whole bank charges thing that this is a massive racket, and it's a massive racket that's been going on for years. We campaigned very strongly against these bank charges a long time ago and helped people reclaim them. And then there was a famous case that went backwards and forwards in the highest courts in the land, and unfortunately the banks won that case, and that meant that they could continue with this racket and that these charges weren't unfair. But they are basically lending people money that they shouldn't be able to have. You've got your money, and then you've got your overdraft, and then you've got your unarranged overdraft. An unarranged overdraft is code for money you shouldn't be able to have, and they shouldn't be lending people this money. If they'd have invested anywhere near as much in their systems in terms of stopping people being able to have money that they shouldn't have, as they've done in lots of other things over the years, then it would have saved people a lot of financial hardship. And basically, they just cash in on it. And fortunately, they're not cashing in on it anywhere near as much as they were before the whole bank charges furore, but it's pretty outrageous that all these years later they are still doing it. So,
from one racket to another.
And on more borrowing that people have that maybe they shouldn't have. The 0% credit card bonanza has been catching the eye of late.
Explain to us about what that is.
The financial authorities. So basically, the 0% balance transfer and 0% purchase cards have been around for some time. And the idea is that you get a promotional period on your card during which you benefit from 0% interest. You can borrow completely interest-free. There's normally a small interest charge on the whole balance to transfer the money, but that's a relatively minor amount compared to the amount of money you're managing to borrow, unsecured, interest-free. And the longest balance transfer at the moment is 43 months interest-free. And as has been commented before on this show, why would a credit card company lend you money interest-free for 43 months? Is it because they're just nice people? Is it because they just want to help you out financially and help you spread the cost without incurring anything as pesky as interest charges? Or is it because they know that enough people will not pay that money back within the allotted time, or will in other ways fall foul of the rules and end up paying much higher rates of interest, i.e. nearly 20%? I don't think we need to sit and think for too long before we realise that obviously the answer to the question is number three there. And what has ensued here, basically, in the balance transfer and purchase 0% period thing, is this war of attrition where every time one raises, the other raises, and the other raises, and the other raises, to the point where we've gone from 12-month interest-free balance transfers to more than 3 years, nearly 4 years. I don't know. Maybe we will get to 4 years. And the problem is, of course, is that this is a brilliant wheeze for the banks and the credit card companies, because it's making the money. If it wasn't making the money, they wouldn't be doing it. There's two reasons why they're doing it. One, this obsession with customer growth that means they have to relentlessly chase down new customers. And the only way of relentlessly chasing down new customers is you up it by a month to pull people in. Then someone else ups it by a month, so you up it by a month. That game works. They're making money off the back of it. And this is a concern because basically, A, it's a concern for the banks themselves. This was raised this week in a story in the FT by a couple of senior bankers who said that banks are kind of forward booking the money that they make from these cards. Mm. And they could fall foul of it in a similar Tesco accounting scandal style way. And also, there's a worry about the amount of debt, because consumer debt has risen substantially. We borrow a very large amount on our credit cards, and these teaser rates are basically sucking people into debt and then charging them much more interest than they think they're going to pay. Because people don't go into a 43-month 0% balance transfer thinking, yeah, I'll definitely not pay that back in time. Yeah. I'll definitely end up paying them 20% interest. I'll definitely do that. They go into it thinking they will pay them back in time, and then they don't do it. But the FCA has said it's got its eye on this. The Bank of England has said it's got its eye on this. The banking industry has got a bit of an eye on this and has been sort of indicating that it might rein things in a bit. So I think it's very interesting to watch. And I think there's nothing wrong, in essence, with a 0% balance transfer card or purchase card if you play by the rules. You pay it back in time. You don't miss a payment. You don't do any extra spending that suddenly bumps the rate up. You don't suddenly forget that your deal has run out and end up with a gap before you move on to another one. If you can manage your money in that way, then you can win at this game. And there are people who do win at this game. But if you can't manage your money in that way, then there's probably a better way of borrowing money or not borrowing the money at all. And also, I think that what's going to happen at the margins when this starts to slow down, because people always make the mistake of, and this happened last time around in the credit crunch, people borrowed on two-year fixed-rate mortgages on the basis that they thought they could always remortgage at the end of it. And people do that with these cards, I think. Quite a sizable number, they think they'll always be able to get another one at the end of it. Well, if things change, you might not be able to get another one at the end of it. And what happens if you do suddenly get bumped onto a near 20% interest rate? So I don't think it's impending financial doom and disaster, but it is a house of cards, and I think it'd be very interesting to see what happens and whether they manage to kind of very gently deflate what looks a bit bubbly, or whether something goes pop.
The key thing is with this, if you have got a credit card where you're getting stung monthly on it, or you have got debts that you're struggling to pay off, if you can shift the debt onto a 0% credit card, you say 43 months, usually a 3% fee, you can get 28 months with a 0% fee. So you can still get a card that's longer than 2 years without even having to pay a fee to shift the money across. But you have to have a repayment plan in place. And it's a very simple way of looking at it. If you're shifting $5,000 of debt, you know, you've got 43 months to pay it off. You just work out what you're going to need to pay each month to pay off. And you need to know that you can solidly make that payment every month. If you're going to have any troubles with that, and you're going to end up even with £1,000 at the end of it, you are going to be stung heavily at the end of that balance transfer rate of 0%. Mm. Because as Simon says, you know, they're going to be probably like 22% APR or something on it. And that is a big sting in the tail. And if people just keep simply shifting the debt on and on and on, they're the people that are really in danger here.
All right, then, we spoke about rackets. We're going to be talking about another one now, as some people might feel that it is. Talking of threats to that pound in your pocket, perhaps one of the most annoying, parking fines. We're seeing a rise with car park operators raking in millions, many of those for minor infringements. But you found they're even buying drivers' address details from the DVLA and sending out threatening letters. But again, it seems if you complain, you could get that fine rescinded. In fact, around half of those who appeal are typically successful. So what sort of things are people being fined for, Lee?
Oh, George, this is one of those things that people get on people's goats, this. And it's like, you know, some of the fines are just so outrageous, you know, for being overstaying a car park for like a couple of minutes. You know, it's just like no leeway whatsoever. And as you rightly say, I mean, 50% of cases, they tend to get quashed. That's a large amount of parking tickets that get quashed if you complain.
Does that mean that they're wrong? So just think, if you don't complain, you just pay it.
Well, this is it. They scare people into paying it, because what often happens is that you'll have, say, 2 weeks, and they'll say this is a reduced payment you can make. So maybe it'll be £35. If you don't pay it within this 2 weeks, it's going to go up to £70. And that scares a lot of people into just simply paying it, because they think, well, 35 quid, I don't want to pay 70 quid, and I'll just pay it, I'll just do it. And look, I'm not going to dispute that sometimes people do bend the rules and do deserve parking tickets, but sometimes signage is confusing, and that's where a lot of the appeal comes down for. If there's poorly marked signs, that's a real key one. So when you do park and you can't see a sign, just make sure you get some evidence of it. Tickets not visible, might fall off the dashboard. 3 minute rule. You know, you have got a few minutes to go and get a ticket. That's almost like the dread, isn't it? You know, you park, you know, well, it's just me, I need to go get a parking ticket. No, to actually park it legitimately. What if someone comes in the meantime? Are they going to believe me? But it's a worrying thing, I think, when I read this story, and I didn't realise this before. People's addresses are being bought.
Yeah, this is what got me. Everyone knows you get fined for parking and all that, but
so basically, being billed as the latest trick, but the DVLA is providing private address details that can be traced from car number plates. And in an age now where we've got lots of cameras that track your number plates, so if you go in a car park, a lot of them now do register your car number plate and say you've got an hour free parking here. If you fall foul of that, you know, even a minute out of that car park, you know, you can get done. And that's exactly what happened to our old friend Barry Beavis. Took the parking fines all the way up to the Supreme Court, and unfortunately lost that case, where he argued that he was in a traffic jam getting out of the car park.
He said it was unreasonable. And it was completely
an unreasonable fine. But 4.7 million people last year had their addresses bought for £2.50 a pop by car park operators, and it earned the DVLA £12 million.
That is a racket. I'm sorry. How is that allowed?
I've been doing some investigations into this, and we will be doing some more, actually. So not to sort of preclude that, but there's been a big rise in this since Barry Beavis lost this court case. And these two things are related. The use of automatic number plate recognition cameras by private companies who run these private car parks for other companies, perhaps for retail parks or things like that. One of the big ones is called Parking Eye. That's owned by Capita, one of our favourite outsourcing companies. Basically, what appears to be going on here is a major escalation in this war on people overstaying even for a few minutes, catching them not with someone walking around giving them a ticket, but with the cameras. So the camera films the car going in, the camera films the car going out. Did you have a ticket? If you didn't have a ticket, you're bang to rights. And you used to be able to argue this, that the fines were disproportionate. That was what Barry Beavis was trying to argue. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court found against him. So you kind of used to be able to tell the parking operators that you weren't paying them. Or you could send them a cheque for what you thought was a reasonable amount of money if you really wanted to do the right thing. But you could kind of just tell them to get stuffed. Unfortunately, you can't tell them to get stuffed now. And they're actually quoting the Barry Beavis case on the tickets and the letters that they are sending to people saying, and as you'll know from the Supreme Court judgment, this is legally enforceable and so on. And the way that they get the details from the DVLA, to go back to your question, is the DVLA sells them for £2.50. Now, it says it does this in order to cover the cost of giving them the details so that the taxpayer doesn't have to bear the brunt of that. And you are able to get someone's details from the DVLA with their license plate number if you have reasonable cause for needing it. Reasonable cause for needing it in the DVLA's eyes includes parking on someone's land. And they say that if they were to, I believe when questioned about it before, I'm not going to put words into their mouth, so I'm going to paraphrase here, and I'm saying I'm paraphrasing, but I believe their argument is that if they refuse to give these details, then people would just be able to park wherever they wanted and you wouldn't be able to enforce parking. But what is going on here is that people up and down the country are being hammered by these private parking firms who are now getting away with an awful lot due to this court case and the use of automatic number plate recognition cameras. And the DVLA is essentially complicit in it. And the DVLA is an arm of the government. So, I mean, take it up with your MP if they do come knocking on your door. Ask them what they're going to do about that one.
All right, then, as we always like to put the alternative position, which I think you've done rather nicely. So the DVLA say it so that we, the taxpayer, don't have to foot the bill, and it's perfectly legitimate. So that's all right, everybody. I hope you're feeling good right now. All right, then, we're going to move on from this. And I want to ask you, Simon, have you finally got your hands on a new pound coin, the safest, most secure pound coin ever, unrivaled in the world? Yes. Well, probably for the wrong reasons right now. Minting errors have apparently caused thousands to melt, to crack, and even have the middle drop out. Few tons, I'm sure, going on sale on eBay. David Braithwaite is from Citrus Financial Management.
The first forgeries come out now. So the most forged coin was the previous pound coin, and this was the safest ever, and they're forging them now. And the trouble is that these are new coins. I was with a friend of mine the other day. It was the first one that he'd seen. So how would he know if what he's got is a forgery or is the real thing? Because he has no benchmark. So these things are coming out. But I think it's in a way quite funny because people, when the £5 note came out, people are trying to collect the ones with the low serial numbers. Yeah. So now people are looking at this new pound coin thinking, I want to find one that looks like a polo. And it makes it more interesting, I think. And we're talking about money. I don't mind it. I mean, yeah, there's going to be flaws. There's going to be. They're producing billions of these coins. So there's going to be the odd anomaly that's happening out there. But let's see what happens and see what happens on auction websites, because I think a few of those are going to start appearing on there and making them collectible. It makes money more talkable. Is it a bad thing? I don't know. But it does just go to show that they came out with this big fanfare of this is the most safest coin ever. And actually, there's a few mess-ups going on with it. So it isn't quite as perfect. So it just goes to show that perhaps the Royal Mint is as human as we all are.
So, Lee, I remember your trip to the Royal Mint. You were so excited. You were so excited.
I remember it like it was yesterday.
How embarrassing.
Look, Georgie, I mean, this exact same story actually happened with £2 coins. You can tap the middle out of them if you use excessive force. As in, if you put them in like a, you know, a vise and you start bloody tapping at it with a hammer, I'm sure it will fall out eventually. These things are melded together for everyday use, but there's always going to be people that are going to go out there and try and find a way to make a quick buck.
So is that it? It's not the Royal Mint's fault. It's because people have been putting them in vices and cracking them with hammers, because that's what I do of an evening.
But I wouldn't be surprised, because, you know, the thing is, there's been a real coin mania in the last 12
Your
months.
Your fault.
And I've got no idea whose fault it is. It's obviously just really sort of, you know, the bubbling excitement out there. I mean, what's happening is a lot of coins are ending up on eBay, and a lot of coins on eBay that get listed for big amounts of money are if they've got minting errors, right? So this is
conspiracy theory.
I think it's a bit of a conspiracy theory. And also the other conspiracy theory is, of course, that I turned up and sabotaged some of the machines.
Yeah.
I'm joking. But if you have genuinely got one that, you know, has got some sort of minting error, then perhaps it might be worth a little bit of money. But, Georgie, I mean, the thing is, if you're going to make a coin out of two different metals and bind them together, the chances are that, you know, if you really do use excessive force, it will fall out. I don't think it's going to be a case of you getting a pound coin in your change and, ooh, the middle's falling out.
Well, yeah, but they're saying melt, crack. You know, don't bill it as unrivaled in the world.
You always need to be careful if you bill anything as unrivaled in the world, really, don't you?
It's
a classic. It's a classic thing. For example, if you ever write a story about people making mistakes, you can guarantee there'll be a typo in it. It's just one of those things in life. I have had a new pound coin. I got it last weekend.
Oh, yeah.
I was very excited by it. Finally spent some cash, finally got some change, finally got a new pound coin. Must admit, the first thing I thought of was not smashing the middle out of it with a hammer. Maybe I could have turned a quick bank holiday buck there. But I think that what got me, though, this week, what really tickled me, was read out on the radio a letter to the Telegraph from someone who said that, unlike the old thruppenny bit, he was having problems with the new pound coin because he used to be able to stack thruppenny bits on their side, and apparently the new pound coin, despite having those, not having the rounder, the round edge, having those slightly flattened sides, you can't stack them in the same way.
God, what are they playing at?
Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.